Today I just want to essentially tell the story. Every year we come around to this season and there's so many different ways to approach it. We all know about the birth of Christ because the Christmas celebration is so often demonstrated and displayed, and it's not that difficult to understand. The babe was born, people came and worshipped him, there were miracles at his birth, a divine star was there. You can draw from that much deeper meaning. The divine star representing the spiritual eye perceived in meditation, the wise men following their intuition to see the divine incarnate. But nonetheless, the story has a certain charming simplicity to it. Then we have in the Bible, up to the age of 12, Jesus is there and there's a few little incidents that happen. And then at the age of 12, he goes with his family to Jerusalem to celebrate. And then when his family leaves, and they're caravanning with many of their friends and neighbors, Jesus is left behind. And they are some days away from the city before they realize that he's nowhere among them. And with great concern, naturally, they rush back to find him. And they find him sitting in the temple, 12 years old, calmly teaching and understanding that the temple was a kind of a meeting place at that time. And there were many places and many different rabbis, many different learned scholars or wise individuals who would take a seat of learning and then hold forth, and people would come and talk. And there was a great deal of hearty give and take. And they would propound a certain truth, and then it would be argued whether it was true or not. And so they find Jesus calmly at the age of 12, just sitting in one of these chairs of learning, holding forth. And his family is so relieved to see that he's well and that he's not lost. And his response is entirely unexpected, given his youth. "Why have you come for me?" He says, "What are you doing here, basically? Don't you know that I have to be about my father's business?" Meaning, do you think that I really came just to be your child? Just to live with you in your little life? I'm here. I'm holding forth. I'm doing what I came to do. And then the Bible goes essentially silent. They obviously gather him up and take him home. But you can see already that there is a conflict. And now we come to what is commonly called the lost years of Jesus, which Paramhansa Yogananda and many other scholars and seers are now beginning to fill in those lost years. And there's a great deal of evidence that those years were simply taken out of the Bible. It's impossible, quite frankly, that he didn't talk to his disciples about what he did and that nobody asked him and nobody made a note. It just defies common sense. The way Master puts it, simply, they had the nerve to take some things out, but nobody had the nerve to recreate a new biography for him. Yogananda was even more explicit. Jesus went back to his family, and his family began making plans to create for him a more or less ordinary life. Even in Paramhansa Yogananda's own life, there he was, an avatar with this great destiny. His mother took him as a baby to the Guru Lahiri Mahashaya, and Lahiri declares about Yogananda, "Your son is a spiritual engine, and he will draw the train of many thousands of souls to God." And still, his family wanted to find a bride for him, get him married, get him settled down, you know, have him raise a family. Yogananda actually says, and I'm just going to present this, that Jesus ran away because they were trying to arrange a marriage for him. And that's Yogananda's statement about it, just a flat fact like that. In other words, there was already a dichotomy between the expectations of others and what he knew. And you see the peak of that when his family rushes back to get him and he says, "What are you doing here? I'm doing what I was born to do. What do you think my life is about?" So many sources, including Yogananda, tell us that during those years as a young man, he left his home and he went to India, he went to Tibet. He repaid the visit of the masters, is how Yogananda describes it. The three wise men who came to him were three of the masters you see on the wall behind us. Babaji and Lahiri came to see, Sri Yukteswar, they came to see Christ in his cradle, Jesus in his cradle, because this line of teaching is all one teaching. That's why we have Jesus in the center of our altar. You've noticed we've changed the picture now. This is an artist's rendering off of the Shroud of Turin. Some like it, some don't. The eyes of Jesus, if you look closely at them, look very much like the eyes of Yogananda. And the whole demeanor of it, if you look at it, looks a great deal like Babaji. It's a more unified picture and one that's really worth tuning into. Because Yogananda tells us that those masters came to see Jesus when he was young, and when Jesus was old enough, he went back. Even great gurus follow a period of sadhana, sadhana meaning spiritual practice. Yogananda tells us in his life, he had this great longing to meet his master, of finally finding Sri Yukteswar, of going to Sri Yukteswar's ashram and being under the stern discipline of Sri Yukteswar, and then through the intercession of his guru, finally attaining a state of cosmic consciousness. On one hand, you think, but he was born free. He was a self-realized master. But their lives are to demonstrate the truth of the spiritual path. And a great disservice was done to all the followers of Jesus by taking out of the Bible any part of him preparing himself for his divine mission. It removes from his life an enormous connecting link between Jesus and the rest of us. So Jesus goes to Tibet, to India, to be with Babaji, wherever he was, and prepares himself for this divine mission he knows he's going to have to fight, follow, fulfill. Jesus was drawn into a particular time and place to move forward the spiritual destiny of the planet. And also, their mission is always twofold. One is they're drawn because of a particular group of people and a particular group of disciples. In this sense, he was drawn, in this context, he was drawn to the Jewish people. He was a continuing fulfillment of the divine destiny of a very holy people and a very holy line of thought. The Jewish people at that time were the only group who still held a remnant of Sanatan Dharma. The world had become pagan, which is to say they were worshiping this sort of humanized form. They were trying to propitiate this one as a whole. The Romans all around them, all these different gods, all of it very worldly in the sense of materialistic and being based on the world that we see with our senses. The Jewish people still held this deep understanding of the transcendent and unified nature of divinity. That was the heritage from Moses, the heritage from the founding, the first avatar who founded their teaching. But as it would happen, it had become narrowed and narrowed and increasingly corrupt until it was merely in the hands of the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the corrupt priesthood who had taken that transcendent teaching and turned it into something merely materialistic again. The situation was not that different than the coming of Yogananda into the present reality, where the teachings of Christ are more or less owned by institutional religions who have dogmatically asserted with more or less dogmatism, this is what it means, or have reduced it, as we say in the Festival of Light, from inner communion to mere service to others. And so Yogananda comes with what he calls the second coming of Christ to teach again the true teachings of Christianity and the true teachings of Krishna. Because also on the Indian side, that elevated understanding of self-realization has been reduced to priests and rituals. And avatars are not usually greeted with open-hearted cheers of delight by the people in power, because they have a very strong vested interest in the way things are. So there Jesus comes to the Jewish people, and many pure-hearted followers of that religious group recognized him. And even though they had been raised in this one tradition, even though there was a powerful force telling them that this is the true teaching, in their own hearts they could feel that this man had something completely other, and everything in them wanted that. It's a very easy story to understand. How many of us were raised in one tradition and perhaps even loved it for many reasons, were drawn to it, our families supported it, but somehow within our own hearts there's this feeling that there has to be something else. And somewhere along the line, for us it wasn't Yogananda himself walking on the beach, but often it's autobiography of a yogi just sitting in a store somewhere, or some individual who says, you know, I've found something that's very interesting. And despite our attraction to one reality or our habit, we find a new one and then begin to see, yes, this is the progression of what I was looking for. And so Jesus is there and he's moving through this period, this place. Now, as a young man, he begins his mission. Then he goes away and then returns fully grown, fully trained, absolutely ready. And he bursts upon the scene. And some have already known about him because he returned to his own family. And the Bible doesn't include this, but you can only imagine that they knew where he was and they knew what he was doing. But he appears on the scene, and now he knows that he has a very short span of time left in which to establish this entirely new direction. And he has to gather his followers, and he begins this, what can only be a very super consciously guided campaign to begin to declare these truths. And he begins to fight. He's revolutionary. He doesn't just sit quietly and sort of say to those in power, yes, you also have a good point. And then on the other hand, maybe you should consider this. And, oh, I can certainly see why you feel that way. And I can understand why you want it to be this way. And but I prefer... It was none of that. It was from the very beginning. He stood up with God's own power and challenged them and accused them of hypocrisy and accused them of misusing the divine trust that had been put into them. And it was all among the Jews. Later, you know, it becomes Jew versus Christian, but there was no such thing. It was one community trying to find its own way. And he's standing there, and what he represents is this new reality that says, you are not dependent upon these priests. You are not dependent upon these rituals, these people who tell you that they have power over you. You are a child of God. Look, even as I am, so are you. And the powerful people realize, they have the sense to realize that this man threatens everything. You know, it's not usually the worldly people who see the threat in a spiritual figure. It's other spiritual people who sense it. The persecution always happens like that, even at the end of the story, which we'll get to next week, when he's before Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate is the Roman authority, and he can't really figure out why this guy is such a problem. I don't see any problem here. He's not claiming anything against Caesar. He's not causing us any grief. But the priests are saying, you have no idea what a terrible threat this man is. He's going to wreck everything. Finally, Pontius Pilate kind of shrugs his shoulders and says, okay, if that's how you feel about him, that's how we'll deal with it. Now, coming back to where we are, Jesus has to be able to communicate to the people around him that he's no ordinary rabbi, because there's rabbis controversially arguing here, there, and everywhere, all over the place, and you get hints of it from the Bible, of how frank and open, and still, even to this day, the Jewish tradition of scholarly debate, and, you know, Jewish people, of which I am a good example, like to express themselves with a great deal of fervor, and do not take offense, you know, at this kind of hearty give and take, I'll say again, as Swamiji calls it. You know, cast not your pearls before swine, and things like that that they say. They don't bother to be real careful. They respect that in one another. But Jesus needed to bring forth that I am no ordinary scholarly rabbi. So what did he do? He gave signs and wonders, many of them. And he began to heal the sick. And he began to show that he could walk on water and he could turn water into wine. And these sorts of things, as you can well imagine, got people's attention. And so increasingly over these 3 years until we get right now to Palm Sunday, the controversy is beginning to grow. And of course, there was no internet or video or telephone, so it sort of goes through word of mouth and he travels through the area and then he appears and then they don't know where he is and he provokes and then he withdraws a little bit and all the while, people are becoming more and more interested. And just before this period of time is the raising of Lazarus from the dead. And Jesus had, at this point, provoked the priest to such an extent that they were beginning to talk very seriously about, we must get rid of this man. And it was becoming increasingly dangerous for him to be where those powerful people were, which was mainly the city of Jerusalem. So he had withdrawn, and nobody quite knew where he was. But he, you know, his true followers knew, but he'd pressured and then pulled back. He'd pressured and then pulled back. And so he's a little distance away in another village. And Lazarus becomes ill. And they tell you, Mary and Martha's brother Lazarus. And the Gospel of John speaks of Mary as the one who anointed Jesus' feet with oil and rubbed his feet with her hair. In other words, it is most probably believed to be Mary Magdalene, who was one of his most devoted followers and one of the most dedicated examples of pure devotion to the Master without regard for anything. So their brother becomes sick. Now, you have to think of this in a human way. All three of these people are very, very devoted to Jesus. And it's not really such a popular thing. You know, it took a tremendous amount of courage in that context to be devoted to him, because he wasn't spelling it out. It wasn't like the controversy was all over, and we all know from the Catholic Church everything that's happened. It's just a lot of people together with a lot of different point of views, and this revolutionary figure rising up, and the power that be saying, no, no, he's a bad man. It's dangerous to follow him. You can't do this. So it took a certain amount of courage to stand by him. So Lazarus becomes ill, and they know where Jesus is, and they send word, our brother, the one whom you love, he's ill. Master, come. Come help us. And Jesus gets the word, and he does not respond. And several days pass, and finally the word comes that Lazarus has died. And now Jesus is ready to come. So he travels the distance to where Mary and Martha live, and Lazarus has been buried, and everybody is following the ritual for the death of someone in the family, and they're going through the grieving process, and Lazarus's body has been put in the cave, and the stone has been put over it, and now Jesus arrives. And Martha hears that he's coming and goes out to meet him. Mary stays in the house. And finally Martha comes back and whispers, the Master is here. And you can only read from that, you know, that it was perhaps a little dangerous for him to be here. And also when he decides to go to Lazarus, his disciples say to him, it may be dangerous for you to go there. And then one of the disciples says, let us all go with him and we will die together. I mean, that's just one sentence, but that tells you how dangerous it was. We'll all go with him and we'll die together. So they go there, and Mary and Martha's house is not far from Jerusalem, and many of the Jerusalem Jews are there because it's a prominent family and they're all together sort of going through this grieving process. Then the word comes that Jesus is there. So many of those people also come out to meet him. And the sisters say, oh Lord, if you were here, he wouldn't have died. Because they know that Jesus has healing power. Implied in that, perhaps, was a little bit of, why weren't you here? And Jesus answers that this is for the glory of God. That's why I didn't come. Show me where he is buried. So they go to that place, and there's a big crowd around. And again, imagine, if you were there, what do you think he's going to do? You know, he has the power. Why did he come now? Why didn't he come before? Look at this. Here we are standing. I wonder what's going to happen. You know, it's all very real. This is not cartoons. This is very real. Move the stone away, he says. And the sister says, but he's been in there for 4 days, sir. You know, this is a hot climate. A body is not going to be pleasant. Some of the Bibles say that he might stinketh, which I love the phrase. But Jesus says, move the stone away. And then he calls, Lazarus! Lazarus, come forth! And he calls him from the astral world. Yogananda, in his own life, also raised people who had seemingly died, and one described it, who was called back, that they were far away in the astral world, and they heard Yogananda's voice. They just heard him calling. And they just were drawn back from that astral realm and then found themselves again in their body. And so Jesus calls Lazarus, wherever you are. And he comes back into his body. His body is healed and he walks out of the tomb. And he's still got the winding sheets around him. He has to sort of undo his hands. Picture it. You know, it had an impact. They say to one another, "This is no ordinary man," meaning Jesus. Now, not long after that, it's the Passover time, and the Jews were in the habit of going to Jerusalem. That's where they went. It was the place to celebrate. It was their holy city. So now, all those who witnessed Lazarus being raised from the tomb, and then Lazarus is just around after that. You know, he's having dinner with his family. He's just resurrected. He was sick unto death, but now he's fine again. So every time anyone sees Lazarus, they all say to each other, "This is the man. I was there. My cousin was there. He saw it. I heard it firsthand." You know, who is this one who they call Jesus? So everybody is talking. "Well, he's back. Do you think he's really going to come? You know what the priests have said? They've put out the order. Anybody who sees him has to report him, and then they're going to arrest him. Do you think anyone will report him? I'm not going to report him." I mean, imagine. And will he come? Will he come? And then he decides, yes, he will come. And by now, everything is just, and this is all divinely planned. So he decides to go into the city of Jerusalem. And he knows what he's facing, but his followers think, after all this controversy, now is the time. He's really going to take his rightful position, and the whole world will know who he is. And of course, there must have been those who thought, "And I'm on the right side of the question, after all. You know, I noticed, you know, when the others were saying, I noticed. I didn't need Lazarus to be convinced. I was convinced long before." I mean, you can just imagine the whole thing. And others are still waiting to see which way the wind blows, like this. They feel a little bit, and then they get afraid. Then they, you know, then their fear overcomes them, and then they move back. This is what human nature is like. And then there's others, the really true disciples, who have experienced in their soul the power of this man, and nothing can deter them. They know. It's not from outside. This is when Jesus commended Peter. He asked Peter, "Who am I?" He says, "Thou art the Christ. Thou art the living God." And Jesus said, "No man has told you this," meaning this is not knowledge you got from the outside. This is from within yourself. You saw it was true. And therefore, he said, "On this rock of understanding," and that's when he named him Peter, rock, "I can build my church," not the Catholic Church, "the church of realization, because you have had the sensitivity to perceive and the courage to hold to that." You know, it's ourselves that we must learn to trust in our own intuitive perception. So Jesus then decides he will go to Jerusalem. And he decides he's not going to come in through the back gate and just kind of sneak into the temple. He's going to come right through the front gate. He's going to draw his disciples with them. And in fact, many of the traditions say he orchestrated it, which he did. "Go find the donkey," he said. "Lay the blankets over it. I will ride. I won't even walk. I will ride in, and all of you will surround me, and we will make a triumphal entry." So they naturally think, you know, now is the moment. And even more than that, the power. Jesus has allowed his power to come out. And the living presence of Lazarus has communicated in a way that only a miracle can. And so he starts into the city of Jerusalem, and people are simply swept up into the grace that they feel. And this is what they call it, Palm Sunday, because people so desirous of showing what they were feeling in themselves, they took the branches off the trees and they laid it down in front of the animal he was riding to give him a holy welcome, so that even the feet of the animal would not touch the ground but would walk on this carpet of leaves. And then they laid down their own cloaks. Now, just imagine what that would feel like if you were standing there. This holy figure is coming. And you see the glory and greatness of him, and you in some way want to express your devotion. So you take the garment off your own back and lay it on the ground so that, you know, he'll step upon it with the animal he's riding or with his own foot. And then the songs begin. The Son of David, the predicted Messiah, the King, the welcome one we've been waiting for. And only a few, as that beautiful song says, only a few in that music could detect the sad note of approaching disaster by human destiny wrote. Now, what was the disaster? The disaster was that, friends, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not the satisfaction of the human desire to have power and comfort and position. That was never his promise. He never said, oh, I will make you so comfortable. I will make you so rich. I will give you position in this world. He said, he who loses his life gains it. He who gives up the ephemeral desire for ego satisfaction and embraces the will of my Father, to you I will give riches and joy beyond your wildest imagining. So Jesus starts this incredibly dramatic cycle. And all those who are hoping, you know, now not only will I be able to be a disciple of this great master, but I will also be powerful and recognized in this world. And instead, Jesus is just acting out in very intense, short, but oh so dramatic way, just the whole cycle of human life. Oh, I hope I get everything I want, and then I'm going to hold it. And then God says, no, my kingdom is of another reality. And the celebration every week of this Palm Sunday is this demonstration, every year is this demonstration to ourselves, you know, the waves of this world rise, and then they fall. And then they rise, and then they fall. And the only safety we have is in that profound, intuitive, unchanging connection to the infinite behind it all. And that's what Jesus himself represented. And if one could have stood there and looked into his eyes, and watched him entering as a triumphant king, what would the look in his eye have been? Knowing, you know, that this is just the unreliable enthusiasm of people gaining the wave of, oh, power, power, position, here we come, and then going down again. And then those true disciples, you can just see them, I'm sure, very sensitively just walking behind him, even singing as he asked them to do, wondering, where is this really going? You know, what does this man really intend? Feeling his profound inner detachment, Jesus' complete surrender to the drama at hand. You know, what a story. Isn't it the story of our own lives? You know, seldom acted out on such a cosmic scale. But within our own little world, just as our reading said today, the merest beggar has a story or will have a story that matches the greatest stories ever told. Because this is the story of the human soul. This is Jesus having lived through all of the delusions that all of us live through, having triumphed over it all, and now beginning this Easter week drama that ends praise, you know, torture, death, resurrection, the same drama that we live over and over. Hope, disappointment, attunement, upliftment in the spirit, death of the ego, rising up again in the light. What a magnificent tale.